reached the Euphrates either peacefully or by force of arms, as long as that amount of gold was paid to him. Iyad agreed, and John, true to his word, returned to Mesopotamia to collect the annual tribute and then dispatched it directly to Iyad. However, the Emperor Heraclius, on hearing about this deal, was furious that it had been arranged without his knowledge. He dismissed John and exiled him to Africa, and replaced him with a military man, a general named Ptolemy. When the next year's tribute payment was due, Ptolemy refused to authorize it, and so Iyad crossed the Euphrates with an army, and in the course of the year 639 to 640, he visited each city in turn to demand its submission. He began with Edessa in the west of the region and gradually made his way over to Nisibis in the east. The former opened its gates to him and was rewarded with a favorable treaty, which respected its inhabitants' lives and property, and even allowed Ptolemy, who was based there, to leave for Byzantine territory together with his soldiers. The same conciliatory approach was taken by most of the nearby cities, and they too were given generous terms. Tella and Dara, however, decided to resist. The former prepared for a siege, but Iyad launched a determined assault and, after capturing it, killed its guard of 300 soldiers. Dara lay right by the former Byzantine-Persian border and had endured Persian attacks many times before, and so perhaps felt able to withstand an Arab advance. But it, too, was fairly quickly reduced, and its resident soldiery was wiped out. Iyad then returned to Kinasrin, and for the next few decades the Jazeera was governed from this distant base. This remoteness meant that Arab involvement in the province's affairs was minimal. We hear of no substantial Arab settlement, as occurred in Iraq and Syria, and being now isolated from the Byzantine realm, it was no longer a focus of imperial patronage or persecution. Existing patterns of local government and tax collection were left mostly intact. In the former Persian part of the region, the same local aristocratic families were in charge as before the conquest, and Greek-educated Christians managed the ex-Byzantine lands. The Christians were still the scribes, leaders, and governors, observes one chronicler, and this seems to have remained the case at least until the end of the 7th century. Who were the conquerors? The impression one gets from the contemporary sources that we have looked at is that in the 620s and early 630s, Muhammad's West Arabian coalition was only one among many Arabian groups trying to take advantage of the lax security situation created by the preoccupation of Byzantium and Persia with warring against each other. On the margins of these empires, raiding had become endemic already by the 620s. Even once the Arab conquests were underway in the late 630s, it is likely that some opportunists took the chance to enrich themselves under the cover of the chaotic political situation. A chief with the un-Arab and un-Islamic name of Kanaan, for example, took some captives in southern Anatolia, and he and his followers killed a Byzantine general who attempted to challenge them. These other actors are, however, airbrushed out of history by later Muslim writers, or, if mentioned at all, they are recast as false prophets or claimed as loyal Muslims. Christian chroniclers inform us about some of these raiding parties who were not part of Muhammad's coalition, but they are not interested in the details of their identities and usually just refer to them using generic terms such as Saracens and Taye. It is therefore all but impossible for us to probe beneath the surface of the storyline presented by later Muslim historians that the conquest venture was fully managed and directed solely by Muhammad and his successors from Medina. There are enough small cracks in this storyline for us to see that the Arab conquests were not initiated by Muhammad alone, but had begun before him, and were being conducted by other leaders in other locations. Yet we cannot easily recover their aims or identities. On the positive side, we do have contemporary information on the coalition of Muhammad in the form of his preaching, the Quran, and of the agreement that he drew up on arriving in Medina. What is most striking is the very simple but powerful program of action outlined by Muhammad. Form a righteous community, Ummah. Go to a safe place, Hijra, and from there embark on jihad against the unrighteous, Mushrikun. The latter are defined in the Quran as those who denied or diluted God's oneness, though we do not get to hear much about their side of the story. The foundation agreement that Muhammad made in Medina to combat them was effectively a mutual defense pact. All signatories were obliged to come to the aid of one another if attacked, and a war manifesto. All signatories had to join in the war effort against the common enemy. The term for a signatory was mu'min, meaning faithful. As with the English word faithful, mu'min could mean both loyal and believing. In the Quran, it is mostly used in a very general way, but in the foundation agreement, it seems to have a specific socio-legal sense, designating all those who pledged allegiance to the new community and its manifesto, and who accepted that the one God and Muhammad were the supreme arbiters of the community. The majority were Muslim, whether emigrants, muhajirun, from Mecca, or converts from Medina, and Jews, along with possibly a few Christians and monotheists of other hues. The agreement explicitly states that the Muslims have their religion and the Jews theirs, but for the purposes of the war effort, all were a single community. Muhammad's coalition at this stage was, then, pluralist by nature, with everyone committed to waging jihad against the pagans, whatever their own particular monotheist persuasion. This remained the case for some time after Muhammad's death, though once the Arab armies had entered Syria and Iraq, Jews became much less important and Christians much more so. Later Muslim historians play down this pluralist dimension, seeking to portray the conquests as a wholly Arab-Muslim venture. The famous religious lawyer Ahmad ibn Hanbal died 856, when asked about the Jews and Christians of the community of Muhammad, went so far as to say that this is a despicable question and one must not discuss it. Fortunately, the eclectic and comprehensive method of data collection of many of these authors meant that they also transmitted material that did not conform to their overall message, allowing us sometimes to glimpse a different picture of the 9th-century consensus. For example, Muslim lawyers debated Muhammad's rulings about what share of the spoils of war should go to Jews and Christians who fought alongside Muslims. A diverse soldiery is, of course, only what one would expect, for all major conquering forces in history have made use of groups external to their core supporters. Extra manpower from local sources is always welcome when an army is operating in regions where it is a small minority, and successful armies will therefore seek to woo possible defectors and recruit willing natives. Almost 80% of the troops in the British Army in India, for example, were non-British. Very early on, Muhammad's West Arabian coalition encountered the Arab Christian tribes of the Syrian steppe and desert, a number of whom were allied to the Byzantine and Persian empires. They are often presented as having divided loyalties. Some fought on the side of the empires, and some on the side of the conquerors. Of the latter group, some converted to Islam, but some evidently did not. In an early battle in southern Iraq, for instance, the chiefs of Namir and Taghlib came to the support of a Muslim general with men from their respective tribes, who were Christian. They fought hard, though the battle was severe and prolonged, and the Muslim general encouraged the two men, saying to them, "You are an Arab, even though you do not follow our religion." The conquerors were socially diverse, too. The leadership came from the tribes of the oasis towns of West Arabia, in particular Mecca, Medina, and Ta'if, or else from the fertile highlands of Yemen, where the tribes were mostly sedentary agriculturalists, as they still are today. A substantial proportion of the rank and file, however, were from nomadic pastoralist tribes. The Quran regarded them with some suspicion, deeming them unreliable and fickle, yet their military capability and ease of recruitment were crucial to the success of the Arab conquests, as it was to the conquest plans of Arabian townsmen after them right up until Ibn Saud in the early 20th century. Nomads were mobile, accustomed to fighting to defend their honor and kin and to supplement their income, and the percentage of men that can be drafted in a nomad society is more than twice what is possible in a settled society. Fickle or not, then, they were a crucial asset, and evidence of the drive to win them over to the West Arabian coalition is found in such sayings as that ascribed to the Caliph Umar I, "Be good to the nomads, Arab, for they are the root of the Arabs and a support for Islam," and in general urgings for them not to leave the garrisons and return to Bedouin life, At-Ta'arub. As the conquests progressed and more victories were achieved, many groups who were neither Arab nor Muslim sought to join the conquerors. This is, of course, a standard feature of imperial armies. The initial conquerors will be relatively few, but once they have proved successful, they quickly attract other peoples to their cause, especially those who, for whatever reason, were not fully assimilated or did not enjoy equal status within the original polity. Examples are the Daylam from the southwest coastlands of the Caspian Sea, and the Zut, Sayabija, and Andagar, who were said to hail originally from India, but who had served in the Persian armies before Islam. Some were on bad terms with their former masters, and so jumped at the opportunity to better their lot. In this category are the Luwata Berbers, who had suffered in the course of the Byzantine recapture of North Africa in the 540s, and had, to some extent, been excluded from Byzantine society, and so, not surprisingly, they were quick to join the invading Arabs in the 640s. Others simply did not want to be on the losing side. For instance, units of the Persian elite cavalry, Asawira, offered their skills in the aftermath of the disastrous Persian defeat in southern Iraq in 638, on the condition that they were given the top rate of stipends, and a contingent of Slavs defected from the Byzantines when promised resettlement in Syria, wives, and payments in money and kind. Muslim historians tend to assume that these non-Arab, non-Muslim collaborators converted once they had changed sides. Thus, of one such group in southern Iraq, it is reported that they settled among the tribe of Tamim in Basra in the days of Umar I, converted, fought with the Muslims, and distinguished themselves, so people said, "Although you are not Arabs, you are our brothers and our people." However, we do occasionally learn that conversion was not necessary or immediate. The North Mesopotamian monk John of Fennec, writing in the 680s, informs us that among the Muslim armies were not a few Christians, some belonging to the heretics and some from us. One Muslim source speaks explicitly of the troops of the Daylam who had fought alongside the Muslims without having embraced Islam. And though the Persian cavalry are said to have converted very soon after their defection in 638, they sport very un-Islamic names like Ma'afridun and Mahaway until the late 7th century. It is true, though, that in this age when so much of the fabric of life was expressed in religious terms, collaboration and conversion were often perceived as pretty much the same thing. In short, then, the composition of the conquerors was quite mixed and changed over time, though the core was made up of tribesmen from Arabia and the frontier lands of the Byzantine and Persian empires. Medieval and modern historians alike apply the label Arab to this core, but it is difficult to know for sure how far and how deep this Arab identity extended in the early years. The term is extremely rare in pre-Islamic Arabic poetry, but that may be just because the poets tend mostly to be focusing on their own tribe or allied and/or rival tribes. In the early Islamic period, some Arabian tribes were accused of not being Arabs. Thus, one member of the tribe of Abd al-Qais mocked the Azd tribe of Oman by saying that, in their old age they had themselves circumcised and claimed in their delusion to be Arabs, though they are Persians. Ajam. In this genre of satirical poetry, however, it is common to cast doubt on the pedigree of opponents. What one can say with some degree of confidence is that the conquests brought about a deepening and broadening of Arab identity, for garrison life has a homogenizing effect on soldiers, and the Arab Muslim leaders set the tone. Moreover, such a successful and momentous event inevitably imparted a degree of solidarity, pride, and common feeling to those who participated in it, and it brought them into contact with numerous other peoples, which gave them a greater sense of their own distinctiveness. In general, it is when humans leave their homeland and dwell in a foreign country that they think of the bigger grouping to which they belong, whereas at home among their countrymen they will adopt more local terms. Similarly, the conquerors dealt with one another by reference to clan and tribe, but when confronted with Persians, Byzantines, Berbers, Sogdians, Turks, and so on, they placed more weight on their broader affiliation, their Arabness, and this was reinforced by the fact that they were conquerors, which gave them a sense of superiority to these other peoples. Fighting for gain, fighting for God. We should not, then, view the conquests as a sort of nationalist enterprise, as was sometimes proposed by late 19th century European scholars inspired by the emergence of the German and Italian nations. Though Arab identity certainly existed before Islam, it was the conquests that entrenched it and spread it, and the early Muslim rulers who commissioned writers and poets to give it substance and shape. So what was it that motivated the conquerors to venture forth? It could be argued that there is no need to postulate a particular reason. Tribes living on the margins of states will frequently turn upon those states to supplement their incomes, whether by pillage, ransoming prisoners, or extorting subsidies. Usually they are quickly chased away or bought off by the agents of state security, but if not, they will return in bigger numbers, and soon the affair, if not checked, will snowball into far-reaching conquest. This is what is termed an autocatalytic process. A small initial event triggers and drives a chain reaction that evolves on an ever faster and bigger scale. This is sometimes adduced to explain the explosion of Viking raids that occurred after the highly profitable attack on the English island of Lindisfarne in 793, and also the European rush to embark upon maritime exploration after Columbus's discovery of the New World in 1492. One might object that this would have only led to disorder and not a state. But if large territories were won, adept leaders would step forward to manage the situation, as happened with the Vikings and much later with the Mongols. This certainly fits with what we learn from contemporary descriptions of the early stages of the Arab conquests, where random minor raids yielded success and soon prompted the participation of much larger numbers of Arabian tribesmen. In this view, Muhammad's coalition would have been just one of many groups profiting from the disorder caused by the Byzantine-Persian conflict, though their superior organization and ideological commitment helped them to become the dominant group. The accidental view of history, that is, history as fallible human responses to random acts and events, is not, however, a commonly held one, and usually an array of push and pull factors has been proposed. The most popular factors cited are easy availability of plunder due to the weakness of the Byzantine and Persian empires, on the pull side, and economic and/or environmental impoverishment in Arabia, on the push side. The case for imperial exhaustion has been frequently advanced, though never actually documented, and Heraclius's defeat of the Persians and subsequent failure to prop up their government at their hour of greatest weakness has recently been described as Heraclius's gift to Islam. The idea that there was a worsening economic and/or environmental situation in Arabia was in vogue in the first half of the 20th century, but fell out of favor thereafter. However, recent archaeological surveys of East and West Arabia reveal a substantial drop in settlement activity in the 5th and 6th centuries, and the collapse of ancient Yemen after a tradition of 1,500 years is startling and must have had a negative impact on neighboring communities. Presumably, Arabia suffered the same sort of fall in economic activity in the 5th and 6th centuries as Europe did in the 4th and 5th centuries, and, as happened in Europe, a number of Arabia's residents turned to raiding their imperial masters in order to make good the shortfall in their income. Given that political instability and economic retraction were afflicting numerous areas from the Balkans to China, it is possible that this deterioration in material conditions was much more widespread. Plausibly, there were climatic and/or environmental stresses affecting large parts of Eurasia that were putting empires under strain and leaving them more exposed to the predations of steppe and desert peoples around them, but this needs further investigation. In recent years, and especially since the rise of radical Muslim groups like Al-Qaeda, the most often cited pull factor is Islam, which is assumed to have unified the diverse Arabian tribesmen under one banner and filled them with the zeal to do God's work in fighting all non-believers and to bring God's rule to the whole world. This is the message that 9th century Muslim historians propagated, and modern Western scholars have recently embraced it. Faith was the driving force behind the Muslim conquests, as one has succinctly put it. Some of these scholars, however, have felt a little uneasy that a religion that embodied an intense concern for attaining personal salvation through righteous behavior should also have impelled its followers to take up arms. They have, therefore, striven to play down the role of violence in the conquests, though we cannot view them, concedes the doyen of this view, as entirely a pacific operation, devoid of violence against or coercion of the conquered populations. Such opinions reflect an attempt to present Islam more positively in a world in which Islamophobia has been growing. But such apologetic aims, though noble, are out of place in works of history. All empires have relied on violence and coercion for their existence, and yet, since the imperial elite is always small in relation to the numbers of their subjects, all empires make use of a range of nonviolent strategies to maintain their rule, co-opting the willing, rewarding collaboration, promising protection in return for submission, playing divide and rule, and so on. The Arab Empire was no exception to this, and so needs no special treatment. Moreover, by the time the Arabs arrived on the scene, the use of violence for religious ends had long been regarded as acceptable, if not commendable, in the Middle East, at least in certain situations. When, in 388, a band of Christians attacked a Jewish synagogue in northern Syria, the emperor thought to apply Roman law and punish the culprits, but Ambrose, the bishop of Milan, dissuaded him, pointing out that the pious should not have to defer to the impious. And when, in the 620s, the emperor Heraclius wished to rally his troops to fight the Persians, he emphasized that death in battle opens the way to eternal life, and so urged them to sacrifice themselves to God for the sake of their compatriots and to seize the martyr's crown. These exhortations accord well with similarly encouraging remarks in the Quran. Let those who would trade this life for the hereafter fight in God's path, and we will recompense well whomsoever does fight in God's path, whether he dies or achieves victory. Surah 4, Ayah 74. The Quran is equally explicit about the rewards that those who fight for him can expect in this life. God has promised that you will take much booty, and he has expedited this for you. Surah 48, Ayah 20. So, consume the booty that you have captured as a lawful benefit. Surah 8, Ayah 69. And it is made abundantly clear that God favors those who go out to fight with their own wealth and lives over those who stay behind. Surah 4, Ayah 95. Since God was sanctioning the fighting and the acquisition of booty, there is no need to debate whether Muhammad's West Arabian soldiers fought more for gain or for God. The two were inseparable. They were also mutually reinforcing. The gains won by fighting for God made his warriors more desirous to serve him in war and worship. One should not think, however, that this idea goes hand in hand with trying to convert the conquered peoples. In many ways, it runs contrary to it, for the gains will be diluted if they have to be shared with everyone. This point is made very strongly by a number of Arab Muslim generals seeking to motivate their troops on the eve of war. "This land is your inheritance, which God has promised you," says Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas to his soldiers before the Battle of Qadisiyah. "And you have been tasting it and eating from it and killing its people, collecting taxes from them and taking them prisoner until today, and so it is crucial that you fight now to maintain this situation." It is, in effect, a literal understanding of "the righteous shall inherit the earth," as the Quran itself notes, Surah 21, Ayah 105, explicitly quoting the Psalms of the Bible, chapter 37, verse 29. There is a downside, however, in assuming faith to be the prime instigator of the Arab conquests. Besides the difficulty of assessing whether one group is more zealous than another, why should we think that the Byzantines and Sasanians had less zeal for their faith than the Arabs? This explanation focuses very narrowly on one time and place, early 7th century West Arabia, and one man, Muhammad, and ignores broader currents of world history. To take a modern example, Mohamed Bouazizi, the Tunisian fruit vendor who set himself on fire in December 2010, may well have been the spark that kindled the Arab Spring, but a proper reckoning of this phenomenon would have to take into account high youth unemployment, rising food prices, restricted access to positions of power, and so on. Of course, the Prophet Muhammad played a much more crucial role in the uprising that followed his death, and his politico-religious message and organization were key to the future direction of the conquests. However, the fact that other peoples, such as the Turks and Avars, were also striving to conquer Byzantium and Persia at this time, and the fact that there were many prophetic figures active in Arabia in the early 7th century suggests that we need to think more broadly about the ultimate causes of the Arab conquests. Chapter 3. Eastward and Westward, 640 to 652. After losing a substantial number of troops at Yarmouk in 636, the Emperor Heraclius had sent word to his generals and governors not to engage the Arabs in battle in order to conserve precious manpower and to buy time to raise a new army and devise a fresh strategy. He may also have hoped that God would restrain the Arabs as he had done a few years before with the Persians. But as city after city capitulated, panic began to set in. This was intensified by the death of the emperor in February 641, which triggered a succession crisis. Some backed Heraclius's son by his second wife, his niece Martina, who favored accommodation with the Arabs, and others took the side of a grandson of Heraclius, the 10-year-old Constance, represented by a senior general named Valentine, who advocated a more hawkish policy toward the Arabs. Amid scenes of rioting, Valentine entered Constantinople in September 641. Martina and her son were deposed, and the young Constance was crowned. Using the latter's tender age as a pretext, Valentine sought to usurp the de facto military and political powers of the imperial office for himself, but this offended popular opinion, and he was arrested and brought before Constance. The young emperor magnanimously accepted his plea that he had only acted out of a desire to save the empire from the Arabs and appointed him head of the imperial guard. Only 2 years later, however, Valentine's failure to achieve any significant military successes weakened him, and he was hanged by an angry mob. Constance was now secure on the throne, but this meant that an adolescent was in charge of the Byzantine Empire at a moment when it faced an existential threat from the Arabs. In the Persian realm, the proverbial situation had come true. The head had been severed, and consequently the body floundered. With Yazdgird on the run, and the economic powerhouse of southern Iraq in Arab hands, the Persian Empire ceased to function as an integral entity. The local chiefs and nobles of Iran, wearied by 3 decades of warfare and civil strife, and unnerved by the Arab successes, began to negotiate separate agreements with the conquerors that would preserve as much of their authority and wealth as possible. Families were often pitted against one another, sometimes victims of an Arab policy of divide and rule, and sometimes using the Arabs to settle old scores. For example, in return for being left in power in Media, northwest Iran, Khurasad offered to help the Arabs capture Rey, now a suburb of modern Tehran, but once a proud and ancient city that served as the seat of the noble family of Mihran. The incumbent head of this family had connived in the murder of Khurasad's father. There was, therefore, bad blood between the two families, and Khurasad got his revenge by showing Arab forces a secret way into Rey, which allowed them to surprise the city's defenders. They looted and ransacked the houses of the Mihranids, who were afforded no mercy, but gave safe passage to the family of Khurasad, who was allowed a free hand to establish himself and his offspring in the city. For the Arabs, as for many conquerors before and after them, such pragmatic deals made good sense in lands difficult to access, the subjugation of which would demand substantial resources and manpower. In the mountainous regions around the Caspian Sea, for instance, numerous local arrangements were made. To the south, the Lord of Damavand signed a pact of non-aggression in return for the right to maintain his rule and ancestral title. And the prince of Gurgan, and a Persian appointed potentate in Darband, on the east and west side of the Caspian, respectively, were exempted from tax in exchange for providing military assistance against any potential enemies of the Arabs. Of the Arab command structure in this period, we hear very little in our contemporary sources. The Armenian chronicler Sebeios does confirm to us the existence of some sort of overall ruler, for he distinguishes between the general or prince, Ishkan, who was based in Damascus, and the king, Arkai or Tagawar, who resided in Arabia. The latter did not get involved in the fighting. When the Arabs marched out from the desert, their king did not go with them. But he does seem to have had responsibility for major decision-making. Thus, it was the king, says Sebeios, who ordered that ships be assembled and equipped to carry out naval raids against the southeast shores of Iran. These rulers in Medina are portrayed by later Muslim sources as the successors, caliphs, to Muhammad, and as being in overall control of all worldly and religious matters. Responsibility for practical day-to-day planning was, however, borne by the commander-in-chief in Damascus, which for the period 640 to 660 was Muawiyah, the son of Abu Sufyan ibn Harb, whose daughter the Prophet Muhammad had married, and whose cousin Uthman became the third caliph, 644 to 656. Evidently, the clan of Abu Sufyan, the Umayyads, had managed to take firm hold of the reins of the conquest enterprise from a very early date, and Muawiyah's very long term in office, 20 years as commander in Syria and 20 years as caliph, 661 to 680, served to entrench their position. Egypt. Map 3.1. It was a member of a related clan, Amr ibn al-As, who launched the most lucrative campaign of this period, into Egypt. This land was a jewel in the Byzantine crown because of the size and constancy of its tax remittances and its harvests, both a consequence of the fertility of the Nile Valley. Every year it would dispatch some 300 million bushels of grain to Constantinople, keeping its citizens and the empire's soldiers supplied with bread. Yet, despite its wealth, the country's enemies were few, principally the Nuba to the south and the nomadic Blemmyes in the eastern desert regions. The latter are singled out for censure in numerous writings for their lack of regard for the lives of monks and the property of monasteries. But their raids were only minor irritants, and after the brief incursion in AD 269 of Zenobia, queen of Palmyra, Egypt faced no further external aggression until the 7th century. Perhaps because of this, the armies of Egypt were ill-prepared when they were obliged to face the onslaught first of the Persians in 617 to 619, and subsequently of the Arabs in 640 to 642. In the summer of 633, Heraclius ordered his governor of Numidia, modern West Tunisia, East Algeria, to defend Egypt against Arab attacks, and a couple of years later, he sent a certain John of Barca, modern northeast Libya, to accomplish the same task. Presumably, then, there was some build-up to the main Arab invasion in 640, but since the Muslim sources mention nothing about this, we cannot be sure of the identity or objectives of these earlier raiders. For the period 640 to 643, we are lucky to have at our disposal the chronicle of someone who lived through the Arab conquest of Egypt, one John, Bishop of Nicaea. Though our good fortune is tempered slightly by the fact that we have this text only in the form of a late Ethiopic translation of the Arabic version of the original Coptic account. The chronicle covers events from creation to 643, but frustratingly there is a lacuna from 610 to 639, which means that we only have the word of Muslim sources that Amr ibn al-As set out in the winter of 639 to 640 with a contingent from Palestine. They say that he traveled westward along the coastal road until he reached Pelusium at the eastern edge of the Nile Delta and captured it after a month or so of sporadic fighting. Although this is not verified by any contemporary source, it would certainly make sense for an army invading from the east to subdue Pelusium in order to secure their supply lines as they marched westward. Amr then turned southwest in the direction of Babylon, now a suburb of modern Cairo. At this point, John of Nicaea picks up the story, and he makes it clear that there were in fact two Arab armies, in addition to that of Amr, which is the only one mentioned by the Muslim sources. A second Arab army had been marching from the south, perhaps first sailing across the Red Sea from Arabia and then traveling overland to reach the Nile. After passing to the west side of the river, it proceeded northward until reaching Banasa, ancient Oxyrhynchus, which lay about 100 miles south of Babylon, near the southern entrance to the fertile Fayum Oasis, presumably intending to join up with their comrades to the north. Amr ibn al-As, paying no attention to the fortified cities, had by now reached a place called Tendunius, plausibly the Umm Dunayn of the Muslim sources, which now finds itself on the edge of modern Cairo, on the east bank of the Nile. His objective was to gain control of the Byzantine stronghold of Babylon, a little to the south, but he was distressed to learn that the Arab division coming from the south was now on the west side of the Nile. Rather than attempt a siege of Babylon while the Arab forces were separated, he sought to entice the Byzantines out into the open. He divided his own army into three units and placed them at the three points on the triangle formed by Babylon to the south, Tendunius to the north, and Heliopolis to the northeast. Map 3.2. The plan was that while Amr's unit, situated in front of Heliopolis, engaged the Byzantines head-on, the Arab unit placed just north of Babylon would march out and attack them from the rear. The tactic worked, and in the early summer of 640, the Arabs achieved their first major victory on Egyptian soil. The Arab success had a number of significant consequences. The most immediate one was that the Arabs took control of Tendunius, for its garrison had been destroyed in the course of the Battle of Heliopolis, any surviving soldiers having quickly taken to their heels and fled. A second consequence was that it brought home to the population that this was no mere ephemeral raid. The threat was real, and a plan was urgently needed for how to contain it. Many voted with their feet. As John of Nicaea says, presumably with some exaggeration, a panic fell on all the cities of Egypt, and all their inhabitants took to flight and made their way to Alexandria, abandoning all their possessions, wealth, and cattle. Even senior military figures quailed. For example, the general charged with defending the Fayum fled to the delta city of Nicaea, whereupon the southern Arab force marched upon the capital of this rich agricultural oasis and captured it after a bloody battle. Others decided that their interests were best served by collaboration, and John tells us of officials who began to help the Muslims by arranging transportation and the construction of bridges. Concerning two senior administrators, who were charged with organizing the swift provision of rations to the Arabs, John says that they loved the heathen and hated the Christians. We know from the survival of their correspondence that they had remained Christians, but presumably collaboration with the Arabs was deeply unpopular. Some went more fully over to the other side, which is recorded by John in laconic terms. They apostatized from the Christian faith and embraced the faith of the beast. Despite their substantial victory at Heliopolis, the Arabs still found it difficult making further headway in their conquest of Egypt. Many of the major cities in the Nile Delta were protected by water, which served as a blockade, impeding the entry of horses. Others, such as Nicu and Damietta, shut their gates and steadfastly refused to surrender. John goes so far as to say that Amr spent 12 months in warring against the Christians of northern Egypt, but failed, nevertheless, in reducing their region. Circa March, 640 to 641. This was a slightly hollow boast, but it is true that the Arabs had not yet managed to take out the most crucial targets. In particular, the great fortress of Babylon remained in Byzantine hands. It occupied an area of some 5 hectares. The walls were more than 15 meters high and 3 meters thick, while the circular towers rose higher still and were at least 30 meters in diameter. Moreover, the Nile came right up to the western walls, where a small port allowed the Byzantines to get in and out by boat. The Arabs began to besiege it after the Nile floodwaters had receded in September 640. They lacked the machinery to break down the walls and so concentrated on sapping the morale of those within the fortress. They constructed a large, low bridge over the river near Babylon to prevent the passage of ships to Nicu and Alexandria and to facilitate the movement of their own horses and supplies across the river. They arrested officials and confined them in iron and wooden fetters. They pillaged property, burned crops, and put to the sword all the Byzantine soldiers whom they encountered. But perhaps most damaging to the morale of the besieged was the news of the death of the Emperor Heraclius, who had ruled for over 30 years and had earlier freed Egypt from the yoke of Persian domination, and also the ensuing struggle for the succession, which made it unlikely that help would come from Constantinople anytime soon. So when Amr promised that the lives of the troops garrisoning the fortress would be spared, they decided to surrender and evacuated their positions on the second day after the Festival of the Resurrection in April 641, after a siege of some 7 months. Now Amr began the slow but inexorable march on Alexandria, pushing the remaining Byzantine troops northward, their numbers swollen by the garrisons of towns like Nicu and Kadiyun, who abandoned their posts at the sight of the approaching Arab soldiers. The latter attempted an early attack on the metropolis itself, but the defenders on the walls rained down stones on them, and they were obliged to retreat. There, in the early summer of 641, they pitched camp and hunkered down in preparation for a lengthy blockade of Alexandria. Modern scholars often argue, on the basis of later witnesses, that the Egyptians who were anti-Chalcedonian, that is, they rejected the creed agreed upon at the Council of Chalcedon in AD 451, welcomed the Arabs, and only the Chalcedonian Egyptians opposed them. However, John of Nicu never once intimates that he or his fellow anti-Chalcedonians were in any way well-disposed toward the conquerors. He also makes clear that the Arabs themselves were indiscriminate in their slaughter, and that the disunity among the Egyptians lay not in sectarian differences, but in how to face this challenge, whether it was better to submit and make peace or to stand and fight. A great strife had broken out between the inhabitants of Lower Egypt, and these were divided into 2 parties. Of these, one sided with Theodore, the commander-in-chief of the army in Egypt, who was determined to resist, whereas the other side felt that their interests were best served by negotiation and accommodation with the invaders. And this indecision seemed to grip the very highest echelons of government. The elder son of Heraclius promised to send Theodore a large force in the autumn of 641 with which to repel the enemy. However, upon his premature death, his younger brother chose not to respect this promise, and furthermore he reappointed Cyrus, who had been Chalcedonian Patriarch of Alexandria during the 630s, but who had been sacked for his conciliatory stance toward the Arabs. Indeed, it was known that Cyrus not only favored paying tribute to the invaders in exchange for peace, but had recommended offering one of the emperor's daughters in marriage to Amr, with a view to his being consequently baptized in the holy bath and becoming a Christian, for Amr and his army had great confidence in Cyrus and regarded him with great affection. This proposal had angered Heraclius's elder son, but his successor gave Cyrus power and authority to make peace with the Arabs, to check any further resistance against them, and to establish a system of administration appropriate for the new circumstances. Cyrus arrived in Alexandria in early September 641. He went to the great Caesarian church in the city to celebrate the Feast of the Holy Cross on September 17th, and the people covered the whole route and chanted hymns in his honor. Presumably many supported the dovish policy of Cyrus and thought that some sort of deal with the Arabs was the best way forward for Egypt. Once he had consulted with the elite of Alexandria, Cyrus went to Babylon, seeking by the offer of tribute to procure peace and put a stop to the war in Egypt. Amr welcomed his arrival and said to him, "You have done well to come to us." And Cyrus answered, saying to him, "God has delivered this land into your hands. Let there be no enmity henceforth between you and Rome." They fixed the amount of tribute to be paid and agreed that the Arabs would keep to themselves for 11 months, not intervening in Egyptian affairs, while the Byzantine troops in Alexandria would be allowed to remove all their possessions and equipment and proceed home by sea. No other Byzantine garrisons could replace them, and they were to cease all fighting against the Arabs, while the latter, for their part, were to desist from seizing any churches and meddling in Christian concerns. Furthermore, Jews were to be permitted to remain in Alexandria. As a guarantee, the Arabs would take as hostage 150 soldiers and 50 civilians. Cyrus returned with a heavy heart to Alexandria and reported the terms of the agreement to Theodore, the commander-in-chief, so that he might inform the emperor and persuade him of the merits of the treaty. He also acquainted the populace with the results of the deliberations and the conditions of the agreement. Many were at first incensed by what they perceived as an excessively favorable settlement for the enemy, and they rose up against the patriarch and sought to stone him. But he said to them, "I have made this treaty in order to save you and your children." And though overwhelmed by tears and grief, he entreated them to be reasonable. Grudgingly, the Alexandrians complied and raised the sum of gold that had to be handed over to the Arabs. Those Egyptians who had fled and taken refuge in Alexandria begged to be able to return to their homes, and Cyrus negotiated this on their behalf. And so the Arabs took possession of all the land of Egypt. Cyrus died not long afterward, the following Easter, and so he did not live to see the handover of Alexandria, which happened in accordance with the treaty at the end of September in the year 642. Theodore left the city with his troops and officers, and Amr made his entry without any obstruction. Looking back, the event seems momentous, marking the end of a millennium of Greco-Roman dominion over Egypt and the beginning of an even longer period of Muslim rule. But what perhaps struck contemporaries more was that they had lost God's favor. None could recount the mourning and lamentation which took place in that city. They had none to help them, and God had destroyed their hopes and delivered the Christians into the hands of their enemies. Yet this was not then seen as final, for the strong beneficence of God will put to shame those who grieve us, and he will make his love for man to triumph over our sins and bring to naught the evil purposes of those who afflict us. Our chronicler, John of Nicaea, halts his narrative here, but other sources report that there was one Byzantine attempt to recapture Egypt. The Emperor Constans dispatched an Armenian general named Manuel with instructions to oust the Arabs. According to a mid-8th century account, he meets with Amr ibn al-As and approaches him in a disdainful manner, saying, "I am not Cyrus the bishop who gave you money out of fear of you, for he was a pious monk, whereas I am a man of arms, war, and valor," and he warns him to leave at once, "or I will destroy you." However, in battle he is quickly worsted by Amr. Muslim sources are also familiar with the Armenian Manuel. In their version, Constans resolves to recapture Egypt when its inhabitants send him a letter informing him that the number of the Muslims in Alexandria was small and the condition of the Byzantines there was pitiful. Accordingly, Manuel set sail from the imperial capital with 300 ships packed with warriors. Initially, they were successful. They expelled the Arabs garrisoned in Alexandria and launched guerrilla raids against those stationed in the villages around the city. News of this reached Amr, and he set out toward them with an army of 15,000 men. He engaged the enemy, and a struggle ensued that was so heated that it made it into Muslim apocalypses as one of the precursors to the final battle of Armageddon. The Arabs were, in the end, victorious, and this time they used various machines of war to breach the walls of Alexandria. A proportion of the inhabitants decided to leave for land still under Byzantine control, and thenceforth Alexandria remained in Muslim hands. Southward from Egypt, Nubia and Ethiopia. To the south of Egypt, between modern Aswan and Khartoum, a number of kingdoms flourished, the most well-known of which were Nubia, Nobadia, Makuria, and Alwa, Alodia, heirs to the ancient civilization of Meroe. Christianity gradually percolated into the region in the course of the 4th and 5th centuries, and various Greek and Latin sources inform us about the activities of both Chalcedonian and anti-Chalcedonian missionaries in the 6th century. Arab forces were dispatched from Aswan around 650 to test the defenses of this land. Possibly it was meant as no more than an exploratory raid, but they received something of a bloody nose. Fighting was unexpectedly fierce, and what particularly shocked the Arabs was the awesome velocity and accuracy that the Nubian archers were able to achieve, obliging the would-be invaders to retreat with many wounds and blinded eyes. The Arabs immediately requested a truce, and the governor of Egypt at that time signed an agreement whereby the Nubians would provide one slave a day in return for various foodstuffs. In addition, merchants and messengers were to be allowed to go about their business without hindrance from either side, and fugitives were to be returned. Although the Arabs were repelled, their attack may have prompted the different kingdoms of this region to ally, for the next time we hear from this part of the world, there is a great king, under whom are 13 kinglets. He had been prevailed upon to come to the aid of the Coptic patriarch, who had been imprisoned by the governor of Egypt, and to make a show of strength to the Arabs of Egypt who were in the habit of kidnapping the Nubians and selling them as slaves. In 747, he marched out from Nubia with a huge army, accompanied by an equal number of horses, which, so an eyewitness tells us, were trained to fight with their forefeet and hindfeet in battle. They used them to good effect, killing and capturing a good few Arabs and taking much plunder. Hearing of this, the governor of Egypt, not having any means of resisting, prudently decided to release the patriarch before the Nubians reached the capital. An Arabic papyrus of 758, issued by another governor of Egypt, was addressed to the Lord of Makuria and Nubia, suggesting that these two kingdoms had fully merged. In both cases, we get the impression that this distant realm wielded considerable influence, and this is reinforced by the account of the grandeur of the visit of George, son of King Zechariah of Nubia, to the court of the caliph at Baghdad in 836, which caused much excitement among the local Iraqi Christian community. In the 10th and 11th centuries, certain Nubian rulers even managed to extend their authority over Upper Egypt, and Nubian civilization continued to flourish well into the late Middle Ages, as is evidenced by the wide dissemination of Nubian-style pottery and documents in the old Nubian language, which is closely related to certain Nubian dialects still spoken in Sudan today. The resilience of Nubia meant that the Arabs did not attempt to push farther southward to Ethiopia via an overland route. There was, of course, the option of attacking by sea, and one might have expected this to happen, for Ethiopia had been an important trade destination for West Arabians, and it had invaded Yemen and ruled it for a time in the middle decades of the 6th century. Now there was a chance for the Yemenis to get their own back. Yet no major naval campaigns seem to have been launched from Arabia. In fact, the only incident we hear of is the attempt by a small Ethiopian fleet to raid the coast of West Arabia, which was repelled by a force hurriedly dispatched by Muhammad in 630, or more likely by the Caliph Omar I in 641. It is tempting to connect this with the prophecy in a late 7th century Christian apocalypse that the Byzantines would attack the Arabs from the Sea of the Cushites, Ethiopians, and inflict desolation and destruction on the wilderness of Yathrib, Medina. But we have no way of verifying this. We are, however, informed by numerous Muslim sources that later Umayyad rulers used to exile those who incurred their wrath to the island of Dahlak, which was only a short hop from Adulis, the port city of ancient Ethiopia, in modern Eritrea. Presumably, then, an Arab raiding party had made it this far in the course of the 7th or early 8th century. We do not know why it did not establish a foothold on the mainland, but possibly because, as in Nubia, it faced strong resistance from the natives, or else because the rewards were deemed insufficient, since the kingdom of Aksum was by this time long past its prime. Westward from Egypt, Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, Libya. The lands to the west of Egypt proved to be a much easier prospect for the Arabs, and John of Nicaea tells us that as soon as Amr ibn al-As had concluded a treaty with the patriarch Cyrus and accepted the submission of Alexandria, he dispatched a raiding party to the Pentapolis. This refers to the region of modern northeast Libya, also called Cyrenaica, which comprises five prosperous Roman cities, including Berenike, modern Benghazi, Barca, modern Al-Marj, and Cyrene, the capital. It is at least a 600-mile march away from Alexandria via a very flat coastal road hemmed in to the south by desert. The Pentapolis itself is dominated by the mountain range known as the Jabal Akhdar, which attracts enough rainfall to provide a fertile hinterland for the settlements in its shadow. The governor of the province, together with his troops and the richer residents, withdrew into the ancient city of Tokra, which had been equipped with strong walls a century before, and so offered those sheltering within the hope that they might be able to ride out the passing Arab storm. And sure enough, John informs us, once the raiders had seized a good amount of plunder and captives, they retired to whence they came. Muslim sources have Amr attacking a number of other places in the area, even entering and pillaging Tripoli. But again, the impression conveyed is of raiding expeditions rather than the establishment of a permanent presence. As one early 9th century Muslim scholar affirmed, no tax collector entered Barca, probably meaning all Pentapolis, at that time. Rather, they would send the tribute when it was due. Muslim sources also attribute to Amr the first Arab encounter with the Berbers, in this case with the Luwata tribe, which inhabited the pre-desert lands to the south of the coast of Cyrenaica. They are presumably to be identified with the Laguitan of the Byzantine sources, who were famed for never having been conquered and for possessing countless thousands of men. They played a major part in the great Berber revolt against the Byzantines in the 540s, and though they were suppressed, it would seem that Byzantine rule was never really re-established in this interior region, and so the Luwata enjoyed a high degree of autonomy in the century before the Arab conquest. Amr continued this arrangement. He did not attempt to fight the Luwata, but concluded an agreement with them that, according to the earliest Muslim historians, stipulated that they pay a sum of money in tribute, which would be raised by selling whichever of their children that they wished. No clarification is given, but probably this is an allusion to the vibrant slave trade of Africa. St. Augustine, for example, lamented the ubiquity of slave merchants in Africa, who empty a large part of the land of its human population, exporting those whom they buy, almost all free men, to provinces overseas. John of Nicaea ends his narrative at this date, circa 643, and from this point on we are deprived